turn to our Bibles, and we'll start at chapter 7. Chapter 2 of Genesis. I'm sorry, chapter 2 of Genesis. We've just read the mandate that God gave to man to be fruitful and multiply and bless them. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day God finished his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all his work which he had done in creation. I'll read it again. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day God finished his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all his works which he had done in creation. Now, I could start off in a way to try and relate the subject to where we are today, and I could ask the question, which country would you think is one of the most tranquilized countries in the world? Do you know Australia is one of the most tranquilized countries in the world? That our rate of using tranquilizers is higher than in almost any other nation. Now, there are three things which we know are inseparable in the scriptures: love, joy, and peace. Love, joy, and peace. You can't have one without the other. If you really have love, God's love, agape, not human love, eros, but if you have God's love, you'll have joy and peace. You may not always experience life in a restful way, in the sense that it comes to peace with you, but peace is there, and joy is always with peace. And joy is not happiness. Happiness is quite a lovely thing to have happen to you from time to time. Somebody said happiness just happens, but you can be in states of pain and suffering and still be very joyful and peaceful, and we would all recognize that, I think. So I'm not really doing what sometimes we do from the pulpit, unfortunately, saying to you, look, I've got a very practical study here this morning which is going to help you, and look, this is what you'll get out of it. By the time I'm finished, if you'll listen to what I'm saying, you will have a restful spirit. I'm not trying to say here's a bribe. You see, like, if I say this, then you'll say, oh, I can see this point of listening this morning because we're going to get something. That's ridiculous. A ridiculous way of going about preaching and teaching too, and as well as about listening. Now, if you and I were to survey the whole of creation, we would find it stunning. And we do. Even the, you know, I was listening to a man on the radio, on TV the other day, midday, and he was obviously a man who was a strong evolutionist, and he thought everything just developed itself, you see. It's a wonderful way of getting God out of the picture, you see, everything develops itself. Or even if God starts the first little germ, you know, and says, take it away. It's a wonderful way of getting rid of God. He's not really very important. And it's a great thing to get rid of God. Everybody tries to get rid of God. But I was just having a giggle because he was speaking in such a learned way. And I don't want to knock his learned way, but I was looking at his, what do they call it? Tepi? Wig? Toupee, that's right, toupee. Looking at his toupee, and I was thinking, somehow or another, evolution hasn't worked properly yet, you know what I mean? You've got to have a toupee, you know. I got nothing against wigs. I don't wear them myself, but nearly all the Puritans used to wear wigs. Did you know that? Yes, and, yes, they wore wigs. You didn't know that. That was the way they did it in those days, and perhaps it might be good if it starts coming on again quickly for my sake, but never mind. He knows every hair of our wig as well as our head. But somebody said to me down here after we had a study one day, now I understand what God's created us for. When the new heavens and the new earth, there'll be so many planets and stars that God will want us to reign over all the planets and stars, so we'll all be going off to different planets and stars. And, well, that was a new idea to me, you know. And I thought, well, it's not so silly either. The creation is a fantastic thing. And when you look at it, as we said, when I look at the works of your hands, the sun and the moon, the stars you made, I think, what is man? And vocation says man is everything, because God has called him in on to be a partner in that. Yes, but he has to go about in a certain way. So the first thing God did was complete everything utterly and finally to the finest point. In other words, man didn't have to start to create anything. It was all done. And some of you would know, on my desk when I'm writing a book, particularly writing a theological book, it's like chaos. I don't think it's chaos, because I know every book is, and I know I've got it open to a certain page, and you know what I mean, and it's not chaos. I really feel comfortable with that. But when I've finished writing the book, they all go back, the other books go back to their shelves, and then I feel nice and tidy, and my wife thinks that's wonderful. She shouldn't be in my study anyway. It's got nothing to do with her. I don't go out and play around with her flour and milk and things and make sponge cakes or anything. But anyway, here's the whole thing finished. So God doesn't call us in to start to be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over it until it's all done. And when he looked at it, he said it was very good, which means functionally good, which means complete, which means it all works together, which means it's all got purpose. That's beautiful. So now it's all ready for us to work in. But the thing that God does is that he desists from his work. So we're told that he finished his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Now, it didn't say he rested in the sense that God was exhausted because he had worn himself out creating the universe. He only spoke and it was done, and it was dynamic speaking. Some of us try dynamic speaking with our children, don't we? Don't do that. Do that. And often it proves to be very undynamic. I mean, the children just do what they want to do. Other people's children I'm talking about, not yours and mine. But God, so we're not thinking of God being, but he stopped. He desisted from his work. And so he made the seventh day. Now, the interesting thing is that in the first chapter, every time God does a creative work, he does eight creative works in the first chapter, different sections of it, and we won't go into those. But each day it says, and I'm just reading from the end of chapter 1, and there was evening and there was morning, a sixth day. The composed as the day, obviously. There was evening and there was morning, a sixth day. As you know, the Jews, from sunset till the next sunset is the day, and so that's how they say. So God didn't close off the seventh day. It's not written there. Why didn't he close it off? Because it is now the seventh day. That's the day we live in. We live in the day of God's desisting from work, his rest. We live in the rest of God. That is why you, in 6 days you shall do, you know, shall work, do all you have to do, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you'll do no manner of work and so on. So it means that God says to you, work 6 days, and he doesn't say work 5 days. He says in 6 days do all that you have to do. And he doesn't say do less than you have to do, and he doesn't say do more than you have to do. But he says do all you have to do, and the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. Now, Jesus said on one occasion that he said the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Now, that is an extraordinary statement. Because, you know, he many times healed on the Sabbath. So if you think that God stopped working on the Sabbath, you're wrong. But he desisted from his work of creation because it was completed. What more could he do? What more should he do? And the answer is it's complete, so he doesn't have to do anything more. But he does uphold the creation. And in one sense, every thing that comes into view and to life in the cycle of the animal and the mineral and the, or particularly the vegetable world, is in one sense it's a new creation. God goes on creating all the time. And you remember Jesus said, my Father has always been working and I go on working, meaning My Father's never stopped working, and I've never stopped working. We've worked together all the time. And the Holy Spirit could well say the same thing, that God worked by creating, and he works by redeeming, and he works by glorifying, and that's going on all the time. So the Sabbath is not a day in which you just loll around, but it means you desist from that particular work which you should have done in the 6 days. And what you do on that seventh day is a day of rest. It's a day of recreation, recreation, and it's a day of utter joy and utter peace and utter love. You're stopping to do that. Now, I think I could get to just about everyone in this marvellous assembly here this morning. I think I could just about every one of you into guilt about not having a Sabbath rest. I think that most of us are so busy 7 days a week that we never get a rest, and we say, well, I must really take a rest, so we just have a nervous breakdown and have a rest. Israel was sent into exile for how long? 70 years. And what were the 70 years for? To make up for all the Sabbaths he had never kept. Sooner or later, physically, mentally, personally, we will meet our exile if we don't have a Sabbath rest. And if you think that the Sabbath is not a bore and it's not a heavy thing that sometimes has been made in Christian history a very negative and a hard thing. I remember one of these dear Seventh-day Adventist women, her husband had become a Baptist, and you know the little poem about the Baptist church, it could just apply to any church, so I don't think I'm prejudiced. It says, Mary had a little lamb, it should have been a sheep. It went and joined the Baptist church, and now it gets no sleep. You know what I mean, like there's something always on, and don't, please don't just think in terms of Baptists, but they're good examples of it. We must always have, you know, home breakers tonight, and then the men this night, and the children there, and the youth group, and you know, all the sort of things that we do. We think we're really Christian if we're flat out and busy all the time, and so we can get into that sort of state of mind and wear ourselves out, but sooner or later we begin to pay the price for that. Now I'd like, if keep a hand in Genesis and go to Revelation chapter 4, and there's a marvellous picture there before the throne of God, and it speaks of it was just from verse 2. At once I was in the spirit, and lo, a throne stood in heaven with one seated on the throne, and he who sat there appeared like jasper and carnelian, and around the throne was a rainbow that looked like an emerald. Around the throne were 24 thrones, and seated on the thrones were 24 elders, clad in white garments with golden crowns upon their heads. From the throne issues flashes of lightnings and voices and peals of thunder. And before the throne burn 7 torches of fire, which are the 7 spirits of God. And before the throne there is, as it were, a sea of glass like crystal. Now, that I used to think, because the hymn said, casting down their golden crowns upon the glassy sea, I could hear all these crowns going bonk, 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 you know, as they hit the glassy sea. I wonder whatever they wanted to do that for. But it's not a glassy sea, it's not a sea made of glass, it's a sea as smooth as glass and as clear as glass. And without any doubt in the world, it's a symbol of the sheer peace and tranquility of God. Now, by contrast, in Isaiah 57, it said, the wicked are like the restless sea, which casts up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my Lord, to the wicked. And you will know that human beings accumulate in the depths of their being experiences and all sorts of muck and mess, and then have crises in life, and up are thrown all this mess and that. Like, if you go down to Victor Harbour in the winter, you'll find the beaches are covered with seaweed and a lot of mess and muck from the storms and that. But if you also notice that before the throne, from the throne issues flashes of lightning and voices and peals of thunder. And if you go through the book of Revelation, particularly chapters 8 and 11, you'll find That's a sign of God's action. God is never without action. As a matter of fact, some theologians used to call him pure, actus purus, pure action. God never ceases from action. How could he in sustaining the world and working out? So what you have in God, on the one hand, is this ceaseless action, and yet, not on the other hand, but with that, a total tranquility. Now, I think that that sea is like a conscience. You see, that if you have a pure conscience, the pure in heart, all things are pure, but to the unbelieving, all things are corrupt and defiled. So if you go into the, have a pure conscience, you are at peace, you are tranquil, no matter what's going on around you. And you're able to cope with all the things that go on around you because you're at peace within yourself. Now, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. And I just want to take a few references that Israel took up in regard to the Sabbath. I just happen to have them typed here on a piece of paper, which sometimes helps you dashing through the scriptures and taking up time. But so I'll just read those to you, but there's one I haven't got, which I want to just have ready to read from Deuteronomy chapter 5. Now, here it is. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished. This is Genesis 2, 1 and 3, which we just read. And all the hosts of them. And don't forget, all the hosts of them are very, very significant. And on the seventh day, God finished his work which he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all work which he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all his work which he had done in creation. It's a marvellous statement. Now, Exodus 20, verse 8, we're in the midst of the commandments. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your manservant or your maidservant or your cattle, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. Now, do you notice he blessed man and woman and said, be fruitful and multiply? Now, he blesses a day. Now, how do you bless a day? Nowhere else in the scriptures, though, do we have a thing or a day or a time being blessed. But he blesses a day. And as we've said, that day is still going on. You see, there's no end to it. So it means that if you and I could somehow or another live in that day, and within that day we are doing 6 days every week, which we should do, we would be in the rest of God. Because God is at rest with himself. I'll just interrupt myself for a minute. There's a great theologian named Jonathan Edwards, and he once said that God has the perfect idea of himself. Well, we'd all have to agree with that, wouldn't we? But he said God is that perfect idea. And when he made us in his image, we should be true ideas of the idea. Following so far? God has the perfect idea of himself, but that is himself. He made us in his image, so we should be the perfect idea of the idea without being the idea. Still following? Now, we are only ideas of the idea, our ideas of the idea. So when you look at us, you don't see the true idea, but you do when you see Christ. Because he is not only the image of God, but he's the radiance of his glory. He's not the reflection of God's glory. He is the idea of the idea, which is the idea himself. You say, what are you telling us all that for? Because I'm saying that we have ideas of rest, have ideas of all these things, but the ideas are wrong. The images are wrong, and we live by those wrong images. So he says, in it, you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your manservant, your maidservant, or your cattle, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, you, that your ox and your ass may have rest, and the son of your bondmaid and the alien may be refreshed. Now can you see what's happening in South Australia? Can you see that the attack on the Sunday is an attack upon the spirit of man to rest? Now, all my ministry almost, I've done everything on the run. Laurel and I've been over 40 years ordained, and we've lived in semi-institutional work, and now we have a house. We live in a house down in Kingswood, away from the centre. So, and we've always loved being at the centre and loved the team, and I'm sure we've had a wonderful time and still do. But our house would always be open for anybody to walk in, you know, and I'd be working at something in the study, and somebody would walk in, or the phone would come. And we all have these things in life, not peculiar to me. But now I get hours and hours where I can just be quiet, and it's really Sabbath. And you can contemplate the Lord and His Word, and I'm not saying it's ideal, but I'm saying it's wonderful, because we're so busy in life that before we know we're dead. And somebody said, oh, when we get to our old age, you know, and retire, what a dreadful word, we retire, then we'll concentrate on this. Now, nearly all the retired people I know are either dumb, and they sit all day looking at a TV thing, or with their heads bowed, and they're finished, or they're so busy that they're busier than they were before they retired. So when in your lifetime do you get time to contemplate these wonderful things? And I don't mean go all religious and read the Bible endlessly and theological books. I don't mean that. Listen to this. This is Exodus 31:12. The Lord said to Moses, "Say to the people of Israel, you shall keep my Sabbath, for this is a sign between you and me throughout your generations, that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you. You shall keep the Sabbath, because it is holy for you. Everyone who profanes it shall be put to death. Whoever does any work in it, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall be put to death. Therefore, the people of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout the generations as a perpetual covenant." Now, the everlasting covenant is the covenant of creation, which then has to have other successive covenants to bring it back to creation. Can you follow that? The covenants of blood. So, perpetual covenant. It's a sign forever between me and the people of Israel that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. Now, in Deuteronomy 5, verse 12, "Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your manservant or your maidservant or your ox or your ass or any of your cattle or the sojourner who is within your gates, that your manservant and your maidservant may rest as well as you." Now the big money moguls are saying we want them working 7 days a week to bring in money for us. "You shall remember that you were a servant in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm." See, you were, the word I'm reading out as servant is really a slave. You remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Remember, they were not allowed to have a Sabbath in Egypt. And they worked all the time, and what it did to them. And there was horrible bondage, because when you work 7 days a week, it does something to your mind, does something to your body, does something to your spirit, does something to your attitude. And the big thing, of course, and so I don't forget it, is that you're really saying to God, you didn't finish everything in 6 days. I've got to go on and do something to add to that. And what is more, since I know what is good and evil as well as you do, I can work out whether I would have a Sabbath or not. And I've worked it out I don't want to, because I now have to be a creator, and I have to do this and I have to do that. Can you hear all of that? I know some of you have got something like a little maggot wiggling at the back of your mind, which is saying, now where does this put me now in life? You know, where does it put me? Where does it put mothers with children that you know, don't act very nice, that one day a week just lets you have a rest? And a whole host of things like that. But doesn't matter where it puts us. The fact is, could you and I say that we are not slaves to work? We are not slaves to gain? And we're not, you see, nobody has made you a slave to work 7 days a week, but you might make yourself a slave to work 7 days a week. "And the Lord your God brought you out thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the seventh day." Now, you'll get two things out of it. You often get people arguing, oh, the Sabbath is a is a creational ordinance. There's something God ordered at creation. And others say, no, it's something that's only for Israel. And I teach at a college where in the notes it says, oh, that's all finished. That's all finished. We don't have that anymore. And the answer is, well, we have the Lord's Day. But I thought I'd read you a little note from a book I'm reading at the moment, which is called Christ, the Christ of the Covenants. It's a wonderful book. But he says something like this about Christ's resurrection. To be more precise, when the place of the Sabbath under the new covenant is considered, this perspective must not be forgotten. By his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ consummated God's redemptive purposes. His coming forth into new life must be understood as an event as significant as the creation of the world. By his resurrection, a new creation occurred. To be more precise, the resurrection of Christ signified an event which even surpassed God's original creative activity. This is what this man says. Whether you agree with him or whether I agree with him is not the point. In the resurrection, God brought to final fulfillment his creative redemptive program. The original creation launched the world, but the resurrection creation brought the world to its desired perfection. For this reason, the Christian perceives history differently. He does not look forward to a redemption yet to come. He does not merely hope for a future Sabbath rest. He looks back on a redemption fully accomplished. He stands confidently on the basis of what the past has already brought. Therefore, it is fitting that the new covenant radically alters the Sabbath perspective. The current believer in Christ does not follow the Sabbath pattern of the people of the Old Covenant. He does not first labor 6 days, looking hopefully towards rest. Instead, he begins the week by rejoicing in the rest already accomplished by the cosmic event of Christ's resurrection. Then he enters joyfully into 6 days of labor, confident of success through the victory which Christ has already won. I think that's a very fine thought. Do you see that? That instead of resting from what we've done, we have that rest which now launches us into what we shall do. And that's why we talk about the Lord's Day as against the Sabbatarian day. But the principle of the rest doesn't alter one iota. And this man here says that rest has got to be for us all. So if you could see that. Now I want us to go on and see that just as the vocation that God gave us in the creation covenant is in the covenant of creation, just as the vocation or calling or command he gave us is to be so, but it will always be contested by the powers of darkness and a lot of other things. Can you see that? Because it is like that's the vocation. Now take the rest. If the rest was made for you, if God made the rest for you, and you don't take it, common sense tells you that you are doing some despite to yourself. True? And some of us might never realize. Now, I know this, that whenever I get into a state of exhaustion, the tendency is for me then to feel empty and dry. And sometimes I know God brings me to a place where he says, no, Jeffrey, you have been going the limit. You've been stretching it. It's wrong. So I stop, in spite of the fact that I think nothing will go ahead without me. You don't ever get that idea called creational thinking. You know, creative thinking. It all comes alive again. And so I don't want to just impose that on you, but you go through the scriptures and you'll find that the person who works out his own life, who works his 7 days, who is a slave to labour and doesn't enjoy it in the ultimate, or is just anxious to do his own thing in his own way, that person lacks the rest of God. Now you see, God is at peace in himself. He's dynamic, he does this, he does that, but in the midst of it, he's at rest. So I'm asking this question not to get at you or to be preachy, but are you a person who is at rest? I often talk of Pastor Quicksilver. You know, now you see him, now you don't. See him, he's there. Do you know what I mean? The phone rings, he's in, he's out. His wife cooks a good meal. Oh, you can't. stop for that, you're in the Lord's business, you know what I mean? The kids, yeah, they're around, they're a bit of a mess, a bit of a nuisance, you know, but the Lord's work's got to be done. I call him Pastor Quicksilver, and I say his patron saint is St. Vitus. Now, that doesn't just go for pastors, that goes for lots of other people. Two, that's the way we live, and we think everything's dependent upon us. And I'm sounding preachy, I don't want to sound preachy, because what I'm about is something very, 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 very powerful. Israel, I believe, in history, became a great nation and has kept its qualities and characteristics of greatness because it observed the Sabbath. Not just God rewarded, but it carries its own character building, its own... like if you had one day a week contemplation, I don't mean that on Sabbath we should all go off in a little corner and read a book or a Bible or read some hymns or something. I don't mean that at all. I mean if we can just rest in our spirit. Now if you don't rest on that one day a week, whichever day it may be, and not laying down any rules or regulations, but if you don't have that rest, that restlessness of yours will just heap up and heap up and heap up. But Israel, of course, made big mistakes, and it didn't keep the Sabbath. But I think its glory was that it did. And if you go into a study of the Old Testament, the Sabbath, I think you'll find all number of the prophets that keep coming out about the last days and keeping the Sabbath and so on is there. But you would know with me that in Hebrews chapter 3, the writer is talking to Christians who are Hebrews, and it looks as though they may be departing from the Christian faith. And he warns them by Psalm 95, where he says, "Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today when you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion on the day of testing in the wilderness when your fathers put me to the test, saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was provoked with that generation and said, they always go astray in their hearts. They have not known my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall never enter my rest." Now, the rest you have on that Sabbath is not your rest, but God's rest. You enter into the heart of the triune God, into the love and the peace and the joy that is God's joy and God's peace. And Jesus didn't say, "I give you peace." He said, "My peace I give unto you." Peace is about the closest word you get to rest, by the way. But true rest is peace, joy and love together. And he said, "You'll never enter my rest." Now he goes on and talks about this, about the deceitfulness of sin and how you get out of being in that rest. "Therefore, while the promise of entering his rest remains, let us fear lest any of you should be judged to fail to reach it. For good news came to us just as to them, but the messages they heard did not benefit, because it did not meet with faith in the hearers. For we who have believed enter into that rest," as he has said. Now, you are actually in God's rest. Can you follow that? You're actually in God's rest, and you're actually in God's vocation. You are a fellow, you're a partner, covenant partner in his vocation, and you're a covenant partner in his rest. So you have that. And we were talking about it before, how easily irritability arises in us when we can't have things just work out as we plan them for the day, and reasonably to plan them for the day. And so we get out of that sense of rest. "Although his works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he somewhere spoke on the seventh day, God rested on the seventh day from all his works." And again in this place he said, "They shall never enter my rest. Now since therefore it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly received the good news fail to enter it because of disobedience," again he said a certain day, "today," saying through David, not in the wilderness anymore, but long afterwards, David, then says 95th Psalm, so long afterwards in the words already quoted, "Today when you'll hear his voice, do not harden your hearts." So you and I may be hardening our hearts and we are not in his rest. Now there are some parts of my Christian life of which I'm ashamed. I didn't go off and I wasn't immoral and I didn't do dreadful things. But all I did was say, I must have this enjoyment, I must have this occupation, I must do this. Because I was restless in myself and I thought that would calm me down. I just say that, I don't want to open it up. If Joshua had given them rest, that's to say when he led them into the promised land, God would not speak later of another day. In other words, if Joshua had given all the people rest, they obviously got a rest in the promised land, but they didn't get the rest. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. I know God might be saying that to us this morning. I have a Sabbath rest for you. Are you in it? For whoever enters God's rest also ceases from his labors as God did from his. Now, it doesn't mean you stop doing your own works and you're justified and you enter the rest. That is true enough. But it means if you do your 6 days' work and you desist, then you're in rest. And you're in rest because you do that. And you're in the rest of God. Is that clear up to this point? Anyway, you might like to go back to Hebrews 4 later and look at it. He said, let us therefore strive to enter that rest. Looks like a contradiction, you see. Let us strive to enter that rest, that no one fall by the same sort of disobedience. So there is a rest, and that rest is God's own person, and us being in him and abiding in him, and we have that restfulness of God, but we've got that in the face of all the conflicts that are around about us today. But you see, you can't get that rest which God gave in creation except through redemption. Do you follow that? We saw that in our first study, you can't have that full vocation God gave you in creation today except through redemption. And we're going to see this afternoon that you can't have that true marriage except through redemption. Because Christ had to give himself for the church to redeem her in order that he might marry her. Is something beginning to emerge in what I'm saying? There's a covenant creation. It's pure. God gives it all. And if we'd gone in it, it'd have been a wow. It'd have been just a marvellous breeze. But because the serpent comes in to break the bond between us and God, then we want to do the vocational thing ourselves. We want to do the Sabbath thing ourselves. We want to do the marriage thing ourselves. Can you see that? But God's redemptive purpose was he broke into history to redeem us through the blood covenants, to redeem us so we could come back to the covenant of creation and live that full life. Hands up those who've got superb marriages, superb Sabbath rest in your spirit, superbly operating in vocation. Hands up all. That's what I mean. See, I know some of you are just modest and shy. That's the only reason you didn't put up your hand. But if I ask, hands up all those who've got something of this, and it's very rich, then I think we would all put up our hands. At least I trust we would. So Christ comes into the world. When he comes into the world, the angels talk about goodwill towards men and peace and goodwill towards men. So Christ comes to bring the rest. Now the interesting thing about him, he's a beautiful example of what you see before the throne. In himself, he is that tranquil sea. He has the pure conscience. He is at peace with God and he rests. But the lightnings and the thunders and the dynamics, you see them breaking out of Christ all over the place. Do you see that? And one day he's in a boat. And this dreadful storm, which was demonic, burst up in the Lake of Galilee. And he went on sleeping. For all I know, he was snoring. And Peter got mad. Peter got mad at him. And he shook him. And he said, Lord, don't you care that we perish? I should say, how could you be so careless of us? And Jesus said, oh, you have little faith. And he stood up and he rebuked the wind and the waves. He said, be calm. And they were. So we were told they were afraid of the storm. And they were fishermen. It must have been a fantastic storm, you see. They were afraid. And then he calmed them. And then we were told they were afraid. When it all became calm, suddenly they were afraid. See, they didn't have any rest. Can you follow what I'm saying? Like the guy who was at the patent's office and looking very gloomy just after the war. And somebody said, you look very sad. What have you got there? He said, well, I've invented a magnificent bomb. He said, but peace broke out. You see? And some people can't bear peace. They cannot bear serenity. It irritates them. And they land on the shores of Gadara. And here comes this great overgrown hippie, you know, rushing down the thing with his long fingernails and his hair all over the place and wearing nothing. And, you know, the demon, the demoniac of Gadara. And here he is all, and they're afraid of this guy. He could murder, he could break chains like that. And so they're afraid. So Jesus cast out the demon, and then, you know, the demon goes into the into the pigs and $1,500 worth of pork into the drink. Do you know what I mean? And the people around are afraid. They're afraid. The disciples themselves, he's sitting at Jesus' feet, clothed in his right mind, and they were afraid. Because the peace broke out. Peace is something which people can't bear. You know, that's why we've got TV. That's why we've got, you know, got CDs and cassettes, and some homes you go into, there's always a background music. Some people call it music. And kids today, I don't know how they can grow up without their spirits somehow or another being restless. The noises and that, and it's really an expression of utter restlessness. And you might say, oh, just a fuddy-duddy old fella. Well, I may well be that, but I'm no fool either. I think there is a lack of that serenity. And you see, then Jesus shows that peace, and they can't handle it. Ask him to depart from their shores. So we are talking about something, the peace of God, what does Paul say, which passes all understanding. Keep your hearts and minds in the knowledge and love of God. That utter rest. But where does that rest come to us? And it comes to us at the cross. He has made peace by the blood of his cross. Because the wicked are like the restless sea, which casts up mire and dirt. And you see it everywhere today. It is spewing up. You go to a library and you... Sometimes my wife and I just have a little bit of a relax. We get a few novels. And so we pick up about 10 from the local library, you know what I mean? And one of them maybe is readable. It's almost like a recipe. Do you know what I mean? You put in so much filth into an alley, into there. I don't know whether people want it or not, but it's there anyway. And it's there on our screens. It's getting worse and worse. And they're trying to change our minds and condition our minds. But the restlessness of the world. Now, when it comes to peace by the blood of his cross, he comes and speaks peace to those who are far off, that's the Gentiles, and to those who are near, that's the Jews. And he comes and speaks peace, but he can't speak that peace, that rest into our souls, except from the cross. Because all that mire and muck and mess that is in every human being that has accumulated over their lifetime, that sludge, and that utter restlessness when you've decided to do it your way, and you've decided to be your own ruler and your own creator and your own worker, and you do all of those things. Some of them may be very innocuous, some of them may be just very seemingly reasonable, but they're not God's thing, they're not done in the serenity of the beautiful bond of love and joy and peace with the Godhead. They're not there at the heart of the Godhead, so they're not there at the heart of us and in the depths of our minds, and we're the restless people. And then we get these dreadful crises, and they ruin families. They ruin families. And the lack of peace. What does Christ do on the cross? What he does on the cross is he goes back to the beginning of man's creation, and he goes from the sin of Adam right through to the end of time, and he takes up into himself on the cross all the restlessness and the wickedness and the confusion and the pain and the shame and the burden and the loneliness and the isolation and the terror. And nobody can ever tell you how deeply humanity suffers because it's broken its bond with God. If God broke his bond with us, we would all long ago be utterly demented, utterly demented, long, long ago. But God never broke his bond with us. But what we have suffered in our guilt and our shame and our woundedness and hurt and all of that, Christ took out himself on the cross. And he bore our sins in his body on the tree. And I don't speak as an old, old man. I don't think of myself like that. But I think God has shown me things over these last years, and particularly over the last decade. And he's shown me that you will never bond a human being to God except through the cross. You can have all your entertainments in your churches. You can be nice and social and pally, and you can have wonderful times, but if you have never seen God's heart at the heart of the cross, you have never seen God. You only know about him, and you've got your images, but they're wrong. You've got ideas of the idea, but not him himself. And at that cross, God opens his heart of love to us. He's never concealed it elsewhere. We've just not wanted to see it. But at the cross, he does that which removes forever the shame and stain and defilement and all that filth that is there in their depths. I know the practices today around the churches which make me very unhappy are people going and having healing of memories and people, excuse me putting the term, recycling their maggots with their social workers and so on. But it's the blood of Christ which shall purify your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. See, that is where the peace comes to you. He makes peace by the blood of his cross. And you come to that cross, you've no need to go to anyone or anything in order to know the rest of God, because it comes out of that cross. And then just finally, in the ultimate, that in that day, that great day when we shall see the holy city, the New Jerusalem, to send out heaven adorned as a bride for a husband, and when we'll be called to the marriage supper of the bride and the Lamb, and where there'll be the holy city, whose gates are open day and night, and the glory, the king shall bring the glory of the nations into it, and where there will be there'll be no more need for the temple, because God and the Lamb themselves are the temple. When humanity is wedded to the Son of God and brought into the holy heart of God in the sanctuary of God, when those the leaves of the tree of the healing of the nations, that is when that covenant of creation shall be completed. And none of that will happen without the redemption that God has had to bring and did bring in and planned to bring into our human situation, who have lost the joys of the covenant of creation, to bring us back to that, and then for eternity into the richness and the fullness of it, when we will have overcame the kingdom of priests, when we will be married to the bride as the bride to the Lamb, and we will have a full marriage, so that our human marriages, however much they may have failed, will long be again transcended, and where we will know the rest of God as that beautiful serene sea of tranquility before the throne. And we'll know all that within the rest, not just a kind of a silly supine sort of rest, but all the dynamics of the greatness and wonder of God, when we will tell the universe of his marvellous works that he's done. That's what God's about in that marvellous covenant. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, isn't that so really, really beautiful? So I think we'll just close with a hymn there, and I think we'll have